This is Rising Up with Sonali, a weekly news and analysis program focused on economic, racial, gender justice, and more. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar, and you can find us online at risingupwithsonali.com. This week, we'll examine whether a clause of the 14th Amendment can be applied to former President Donald Trump and disqualify him from seeking future office. Ron Fine of the group Free Speech for People will explain why a recent ruling could be a precedent. Then we'll go to Jackson, Mississippi, where a water crisis has left thousands of residents without clean drinking water for many weeks now. Lorena Quiroz, founder of the Immigrant Alliance for Justice and Equity, will be my guest. Finally, we'll turn to Rahul Mahajan. He's our foreign policy and empire correspondent, and he'll take a look at the ugly legacy of British monarchy that the recently deceased Queen Elizabeth II symbolized. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. A legal victory in New Mexico, disqualifying a county commissioner from running for office because of his participation in the January 6, 2021 attack, may have repercussions for Donald Trump. Under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, a federal judge ruled that Otero County Commissioner Coy Griffin, who is the founder of the group Cowboys for Trump, is no longer allowed to run for office. Could this ruling bar Trump from running for president in 2024? Joining me to help answer that question is Ron Fine, legal director of Free Speech for People and a constitutional lawyer. He's the co-author with John Bonifaz and Ben Clements of The Constitution Demands It, the case for the impeachment of Donald Trump. We've had him frequently on our program. Welcome back to the show, Ron.
It's a pleasure to be back. Thank you.
So let's first talk about the Griffin ruling. Who brought this lawsuit and what exactly does the ruling signify?
The case in New Mexico was brought by a group of New Mexico voters who were represented by a nonprofit called Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CRU. And our organization, Free Speech for People, works with CRU often. And what this ruling established was that, first of all, January 6th was an insurrection within the meaning of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which bars anyone who took an oath to support the Constitution and then engaged in insurrection from ever holding public office again. And so the judge found in that case that January 6th was an insurrection, and Mr. Griffin had engaged in insurrection, and therefore he is barred from holding public office.
So that sounds like two things were actually established. Are you saying that previous rulings did not establish in legal terms that January 6th was an insurrection?
Many courts, many judges, and even the Trump Department of Justice had said that January 6th was an insurrection. But this is the first case in the context of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which is the provision under which Trump would be disqualified from office, that clearly said that January 6th counted as an insurrection for that purpose. It's not a serious question in dispute by serious people, but you occasionally hear fringe views saying it was legitimate political discourse or just a riot. And so that's why it's a valuable case. It's valuable precedent. It built on a case that we at Free Speech for People brought against Marjorie Taylor Greene. And it helps establish further precedent that would help in a disqualification case against Donald Trump.
Was it based on Griffin's physical participation in the riot. Cody Griffin is the founder of Cowboys for Trump, and he happens to hold elected office. And there were others who held lesser offices. There were law enforcement folks, you know, basically people who were fans of Trump, but who in some various ways held some sort of legal position. So let's talk specifically about this case and then how it could actually apply to Trump. Because as I understand it, Griffin was among the rioters, but Trump wasn't.
That's right. So Griffin was actually present, you know, rioting, attacking at the building itself in the Capitol. And that does make him a little different from someone like Donald Trump or a Marjorie Taylor Greene or somebody else who had a different role in the insurrection. But what's important to note is that the legal standard under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment established in this case against Griffin and also in the case against Marjorie Taylor Greene says that engaging in insurrection does not require that you have been a foot soldier. Because if you think about it, this provision, which goes back to the days after the Civil War, was intended to disqualify the Confederate leaders from retaking power. So for example, Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, never fired a shot. He wasn't, you know, at the front lines with a musket. So that's why it's important that this court, like the judge in the Marjorie Taylor Greene case, emphasize that the term engage has a very broad application, and it certainly could include Donald Trump, whose role in the insurrection was in inciting and organizing it and kicking it off.
And that is a really important part of it. You could make a case very easily, and the special House committee is trying to do so, that if someone like Griffin is guilty, then Trump is far more guilty since he's the one who directed people like Griffin to the Capitol. Although, of course, then others could, and defenders of the president, I'm sure, will make the case that he was simply speaking. It's all protected under free speech, and everybody who participated acted of their own accord. So I imagine that you are, and your organization is relying on the former case, which is that because he actually directed folks to the Capitol, that makes him even more guilty and even less qualified for holding office.
That's right. And I want to say two things on that. One is the history is helpful here to know that the people who wrote the 14th Amendment were much more concerned about someone like Jefferson Davis or Robert E. Lee, the people who gave the commands, than about a foot soldier in the Confederate Army. And that's basically the role that Cui Griffin has here. He was much more of a foot soldier. He wasn't the Jefferson Davis or Robert E. Lee type of figure. The second thing is, in the Marjorie Taylor Greene case, although in the end the judge did not rule to remove her in the ballot, he did say that speech could definitely constitute engaging in insurrection, including giving marching orders or instructions to disrupt a particular government proceeding. And that's exactly what Donald Trump did.
All of this comes at the same time that not only is Trump under investigation by the House Special Committee to investigate the January 6th riots, but also he is in great focus around the potential crime of having absconded with official documentation from the White House, the FBI raid that recently took place, attempting to recover some of those documents, and now this big legal back and forth with the Justice Department. You're seeing Trump have one small minor victory, which is that he won the right to have a special master review the documents that the FBI seized. And this is directly the result of Trump pretty severely remaking the American judiciary, right? And so it's kind of bizarre how polarized our court systems have become. I imagine that the judge who allowed the special master, who was appointed by Trump, is going to be far more pro-Trump than, say, the judge in New Mexico who ruled against Cui Griffin. So that, you know, Trump seems to have affected our legal system already enough to where I'm not sure that it can protect us from Trump. What do you think?
Well, it's a serious concern, but we have to hope that the rule of law will prevail in the end. And in the case of the judge whom Trump appointed shortly before he lost the election, and who, if I recall correctly, was confirmed by the Senate after he'd already lost the 2020 election. That judge made a mistake by agreeing to appoint a special master. The Department of Justice has offered her sort of an off-ramp to avoid further embarrassment on appeal by giving her the chance to stay the order with respect to classified documents so that the Department of Justice and the FBI can continue to deal with, for example, nuclear security documents and not have to sit around and wait for a special master to review them. But in the end, I think that the Department of Justice will prevail in this matter, and Trump can't get away with everything forever.
Well, he seems to certainly be able to do so. He has a knack for getting out of all sorts of scrapes. I mean, that's been his special talent for decades, even before he ran for president and became president. If he is actually, say, prosecuted in this particular case around the documents, around having taken documents with him illegally to Mar-a-Lago, would that also have an impact via the 14th Amendment on his eligibility to run for office?
Well, you know, there's statutes that you can find in the U.S. Code that say that if you violate this particular criminal statute, you're not eligible to hold office under the United States. I don't think as a constitutional matter, those statutes by themselves would block him from holding the presidency because it's a constitutional office. But Section 3 of the 14th Amendment isn't a criminal provision. It doesn't require that anyone have been convicted of any crime at all. And in fact, in the years of Reconstruction after the Civil War, most of the people that it excluded from office had never been charged with a crime, let alone convicted of one. And so Trump's criminal exposure is quite significant, both in the Mar-a-Lago case and a separate case in Georgia, and of course in New York. It is technically possible to run for office from prison. Eugene Debs ran for president about a century ago while he was in federal prison, and he got over 3% of the vote. But Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is a separate provision that's not intended as a punishment. It's intended to protect the country from someone like Trump who would betray an oath to support the Constitution and support an insurrection that ravaged the United States Capitol and almost completely disrupted the peaceful transfer of power.
Ron, what do you make of the fact that there are far too many pundits in the media who weigh the issue of whether or not Trump should be prosecuted by examining whether it would serve a practical purpose, whether it would end up polarizing the country more? You know, they might even admit, yes, Trump deserves to be prosecuted, but what would happen if we did? Wouldn't we end up making things worse, or wouldn't we simply stand accused of partisanship, et cetera, et cetera? What do you make of this sort of punditry?
Well, they're not completely crazy. I mean, certainly it is true that there hasn't been a criminal prosecution of a former president, and it would be unprecedented, and it would certainly upset some of his most hardcore supporters. But the larger point, though, is that granting him a pass, granting him immunity for all criminal violations, including in the case of these documents, violations that occurred after he left office and is now a private citizen, would send the message that not only a president, but even a former president is immune from prosecution, it stands above the law, and nothing that they do can ever hold them to account. And that's not what our system is founded upon. Donald Trump at this point is a private citizen like you or me. Any low-level government employee who did anything remotely like this would already be in prison.
I mean, it's just incredible. I think he thinks he has what he understands as executive privilege for life, right? I mean, this is what's really bizarre. And he even invoked that during his presidency in cases when it didn't apply at all. Unfortunately, this is somebody who thinks that he can create laws to defend himself or just kind of will them into being when they don't exist, but also has a very large contingent, far too large, maybe still a minority in the country, but a significant contingent of people who believe whatever reality Donald Trump creates for them. And that includes people who are, you know, members of the officials with the GOP. So it seems as though the Confederate, the laws that were intended to bar Confederate era generals from running are quite appropriate in this case, especially because there are still people who fly the Confederate flag and support Donald Trump. I mean, there are some very strong links to the past, right?
It's extremely distressing that Trump has been able to develop this sense of loyalty among some of his most hardcore supporters that will see him through anything. But the idea of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment at the time was that the men, and it was essentially all men who had sworn the oath to support the Constitution, then betrayed that oath by engaging in treason, could not be trusted with public office again. And the idea was to basically cleanse the Republic and protect it from future depredations by these people. Unfortunately, Reconstruction was cut short, far too short, and most of the white supremacists who'd led the Confederacy were granted amnesty just a few years after the Civil War and were able to retake power. But as we look now at the Trump movement, Trump himself and those of his acolytes who helped engage in these abuses of power, the idea that they would return to office unchastened, unpunished, and this time knowing that they can get away with anything should frighten everyone.
Ron, where can people find out more about Free Speech for People and where, you know, and this effort around using the 14th Amendment?
Thanks. You can find us at freespeechforpeople.org. And what we call the 14.3 campaign is designed to not only in the courts, but also in dealing with secretaries of state and other elections officials who have the power to determine who appears on their ballots. And take a look at freespeechforpeople.org and see how you can get involved.
And I should have asked also, what are the next steps toward that, toward barring Trump from being able to run again under the 14th Amendment? Will there need to be a separate lawsuit around it?
Well, we've already contacted the chief elections officials of all 50 states and the District of Columbia to warn them that this is coming and to tell them that they had better be prepared. And to help them be prepared, we've even prepared for them a sample language that if Trump declares that he's running again in 2024, they can use to determine that he is disqualified from office and can't appear on the ballot. In addition to that, which is being supported by grassroots activists all around the country, if he does declare, we at Free Speech for People are prepared and have committed to filing legal challenges to his candidacy in multiple states.
Thank you so much, Ron, for joining us. Always appreciate having you on.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
My guest is Ron Fine, who is the legal director of Free Speech for People and a constitutional lawyer. And he's the co-author with John Bonifaz and Ben Clements of The Constitution Demands It, the case for the impeachment of Donald Trump. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. It has been weeks since residents of the majority black and brown town of Jackson, Mississippi, were without clean drinking water. After major flooding compromised a water treatment plant, the city was left without proper access to water. Now, although faucets have begun flowing, it's still not safe to consume the water. Worse, it's not clear when the crisis will be resolved. We turn now to Lorena Quiroz. She's the founder of the Mississippi-based Immigrant Alliance for Justice and Equity, an organization whose purpose is to amplify the voices of marginalized, multiracial, and immigrant communities by active participation in civic engagement. Welcome to the program, Lorena.
Thank you, Sonali. Thank you for having me.
Give us a sense of what it's like to have been in a place now where there are people, there are, I imagine, your colleagues that are, you know, living in a condition that's similar to a low-income nation.
It's a question that I get often, especially from colleagues and friends and family members that, you know, live in the North or in other cities. This is not something that has been going on for days or weeks. We have been in action for the last 2 years as an organization, but it's a matter of decades of disinvestment in this mostly Black and now brown community, which is Jackson, Mississippi. For the last 2 years, beginning with the, you know, with the crisis that many heard about nationally in Texas, when Texas has no water, where Mississippi and Jackson had no water as well, we were without water for 6-7 weeks at the time. And so as an organization and as a part of a coalition that rose out of that, we have been distributing water for the community members. And of course, the ones that are mostly affected are Black and brown communities. Brown communities are often forgotten. Our language barriers prevent the information from reaching the most vulnerable populations, and that is undocumented Indigenous folks, because not all brown people speak Spanish, right? As you know, there's so many other languages that constitute, you know, being immigrant. And so it has been the last 6 weeks with the boil water notices, getting that information out to people has been essential, mobilizing communities so they can know and they understand why. People need to know that this is decades in the making. And then just down to the very basics, you know, not to drink water, don't brush your teeth with the water, and how difficult it is to manage these situations when you have toddlers, when you have infants that do not understand why they're being kept away from the water source. So it's been, you know, hectic to say the least, but it's also painful to see how government is not doing what they should, how the state government is neglecting its most vulnerable populations.
And let's talk about that a little bit more. One of the issues that I understand is simply that when Jackson transitioned into being a majority white city to a majority Black and Black and brown city, you lost revenues, you lost tax revenues, there was disinvestment. And so how clearly do you see race playing a role in what you point out as decades of disinvestment, not just a few weeks or months?
And so recently I was at a meeting of a coalition, and one of the elders spoke about what happened during integration and how you had white or wealthy families, what we call white flight, move on into suburbs. You know, as Black children started taking part in the public school system. And so if you step back and you start looking at history and you see how, you know, from that movement, we have had neglect. It's very clear it's very clear where you see where the investment in the city stop. Our infrastructure has not had any major investment. The monies that are claimed to being given to Jackson are not coming to Jackson. There's also private conversations where we have asked to give up our airport in order to receive this funding, this vital funding. Water is life. Water is dignity. So it is very clear that this is a racial issue for you to request for the airport that belongs in the capital city to be moved out of the county, so that so the prestige and all of that comes along with it can be in your county, which is now a majority white county, and use that as a means to leverage power and prevent us from getting funding. Articles have been written about it. Now that we're getting national attention, it's the time to put all that, forward and to really hold accountable the folks that have been preventing us from getting this these monies. There's red tape with legislation. There's red tape in just about all the policies that are created when it comes specifically to Jackson and the way that we receive money.
Does the Republican-led state government, is it responsible for not enough funding coming in for a city that is a Democrat-run city? I mean, we saw this sort of mean-spiritedness from one party flourish under the presidency of the previous president, and it seems as though the GOP as a whole has, in general, used such an approach, politicking or using refusing federal funding to score political points. Is Jackson a victim of that too?
Definitely. Just a couple of days ago, we saw, and it might have caught national attention, that the governor did not invite our mayor to a closed door meeting to some of these conferences that he's holding. The mayor just showed up. And that is just a direct or just a slap in the face to leadership in our city to not be invited to partake in decision-making meetings that affect, the constituency of the mayor of Jackson. So what you mentioned there, that mean-spiritedness, it is so difficult to comprehend the way that our people are being treated. And it's not as if he doesn't understand, because the governor had a vehicle containing water, I believe it was an 18-wheeler, parked outside of his home so that his family can have access to clean water.
This is Governor Reeves, mayor. Spell out, the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, is a very progressive Black mayor, Chokwe Antar Lumumba. So those dynamics themselves are representative and symbolic of the broader state versus city dynamic.
That's right. And he has called himself a radical mayor, a radical city. As an immigrant, I feel protected in this city because he partnered with us 3 years ago during the raids, when the massive raids hit Mississippi. We put out a statement he was the only mayor who put out a statement condemning what was happening in his state. And so the fact that he has done that and stood, by the side of brown folks and his constituency, it's a clear sign of why he's being left out of these conversations. So it's time that the people rise up and demand. And I think that for us, it's like just a pure organizing strategy that needs to happen in the next, weeks and months, and demand action from folks in power. And I think that's going to come from community, because if you are looking at the pictures or are the small clips that are going forth, it is community that's taking care of community. It's a community-based organizations, it's the community volunteers that are here handing out water, that are letting us know where the elderly are that may not be able to have, come outside and do that drive by picking up from 46. We're bringing water to community. We're bringing water to folks that, you know, that have infants to newborns. So it's community that's going to take care of community.
There was also news around a $90 million contract that the city of Jackson had years ago with a German corporation, Siemens Corporation, and ended up basically, you know, losing most of that money because the company didn't do what it was supposed to do. There's a whole background story around that where there was some good investigative journalism done, and ultimately a settlement where the city was paid back $90 million, only, you know, part of which actually went back into the city, and now the residents of Jackson are left paying back this bond that they had to take out to pay for the Siemens contract, and they'll be paying millions of dollars a year for many, many years. Meanwhile, the water system remains deeply, deeply flawed. So do you see what's happened in Jackson not just as the result of political disinvestment, but also corporate predatory behavior?
Correct. And that was about 5 years ago. We were having the same conversations where folks were either not receiving water bills or ending up with bills that went up in their thousands, and having their water disconnected. And of course, it affected our most vulnerable. And that's exactly what's going on.
And Siemens was paid to install water meters that didn't work.
That's right. That did not work. Mm. That did not work.
Wow. Yeah. So we have a situation right now where a major city of minority populations does not have access to adequate clean water. Water is flowing, but the mayor said it's still not safe to drink. The EPA is investigating it. What's next? Can the residents of Jackson live on bottled water until the entire infrastructure is rebuilt? I understand that the mayor says the water system needs a $1 billion rebuilding, but that'll take a long time.
And that's a best case scenario, right? That's the best case, that we receive this $1 billion to rebuild. So you can only imagine the work that we have to do to be able to take care. And again, that's if we get this funding. If you drive down our streets, the infrastructure is crumbling. There's areas where you can't drive. The potholes are abundant. So that's, I think, that the work that's going to be even begun if we get this money trickling down to us, because I think that's what's going to happen. It's going to be years in the making. And that's, again, best case scenario. So during that time is what we need to be building a community-based infrastructure to protect our people as we work through these things, because the water system is not something that's going to be fixed overnight. It just can't.
This is going to be another Flint, Michigan.
It is. And even if, you know, we get this filtering system working, that the money needs to be invested in the infrastructure. And then we have climate change. We're going to be seeing just some temperatures that have not reached as happened 2 years ago, when entire areas of the city froze up and we had no water. And we're going to see that happening, you know, with different water pressures and even new systems. It's going to cause our system to fail. And so we can only brace ourselves to be able to handle these emergencies, but also applying pressure to government to invest in us, invest in Black people, invest in brown people.
I mean, just is mind-boggling that here we have a country that has, you know, billions of dollars that are given away in tax breaks to corporations each year, that we spend billions of dollars on military hardware without a second thought. And why is this not being considered a massive emergency? You know, it just is mind-blowing that in the world's second richest nation, that there is a city that does not have access to water.
And it's everyone has that same observation. You know, recently we've had a caravan of immigrants move into Jackson from Guatemala. And that's one of the statements that you heard, you know, climate change, capitalism in their countries is forcing this upwards migration. And then they come to seek a better life. And here they are finding themselves with no access to clean water. Wow. So you can, like, you know, it baffles the mind of folks that have been living here for years, as well as new immigrants. And this is why it's so important to understand and to share the narrative that it's a result of systemic racism, of disinvestment, because that's the only way if the community organizes to hold these powerful folks accountable that we're going to be able to have access to this money that it's supposed to be readily available.
Tell me a little bit about briefly your organization and where people can find out more, website for it.
Our organization is the Immigrant Alliance for Justice and Equity. We are a woman and a queer-led organization. We are actually in the heart of Mississippi. We're in Jackson, Mississippi. We just purchased a building so that we can be able to answer to some of these emergencies. Our organization is 3 years old. We're also part of the coalition, but we are raising funds through our Act Blue account. We have a website, IAJE of Mississippi, Facebook, Instagram. And we have been just thinking about how we can build an infrastructure within community to be able to answer to some of these emergencies. So we are very grateful for this time. And also just the fact that as immigrants, as brown folks, we love Mississippi. Mississippi has a lot of beautiful things that are similar to our countries of origin. Mm-hmm. And we want to make Mississippi our home. And so, you know, just thinking about how we can help make Jackson the place that it should be, you know, and bring dignity to our people is something that's essential to us as an organization.
Thank you again, Lorena. Good luck to you. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Sanadi.
My guest has been Lorena Quiroz, founder of the Jackson, Mississippi-based Immigrant Alliance for Justice and Equity, an organization whose purpose is to amplify the voices of marginalized, multiracial, and immigrant communities by active participation and civic engagement. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. Reactions to her death have varied dramatically. There are tears from supporters of the monarchy and fans of royalty who have eagerly consumed media that humanize the royals, but there are jeers from the subjects of former British colonies and their descendants who see the Queen as a symbol of acquiescence to empire at best, or an active sympathizer of imperial crimes at worst. My guest is Rahul Mahajan. He's the author of two books on the Iraq War, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, and The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He also teaches at University of Wisconsin, River Falls, and he is the U.S. Foreign Policy and Empire Correspondent for Rising Up. Welcome back to the program, Rahul.
Great to be with you again, Sonali.
So, you know, it was sort of hard to see all of the social media posts remarking, and first of all, mourning for a 96-year-old woman who died peacefully of natural causes, a lot of people expressing a lot of sadness, and then just kind of sympathizing with the grace and elegance with which she led the British monarchy. That grated against my nerves, considering what the empire stood for. I imagine it grated against yours. Any thoughts briefly on the response to the Queen's death and how it's varied?
Well, yes, I think the fulsome praise you get from a lot of circles, or the claims that somehow Britain is now lost and without a rudder, are silly and annoying. And the idea that somehow she reigned in stately grace over a mostly benevolent British presence in the world, in particular over a British Empire that was, of course, in the process of dissolution during her reign, is it just has very little basis in fact. But I guess mostly it's amazing to me that it's made into such a big deal one way or the other, considering the largely ceremonial role of the British monarch these days.
These days, for sure. But the woman herself, when she first ascended to the throne, spent numerous years overseeing a still active empire, right? She was the monarch for 70+ years. And even if one can say today the monarchy has devolved into a largely symbolic enterprise, she as an individual had at least some responsibility, don't you think, especially about for some of the crimes that were committed in Kenya, the country where she was first notified that she became queen?
Well, the way it works is that the monarch meets with the prime minister regularly and is able to communicate his or her opinion on events any which way they want. And of course, they also have a little bit of an advantage in the sense that, especially with someone like Elizabeth, they have represent a certain continuity while the prime minister changes from one person to another, one party to another. That said, it is purely an advisory role, and it's a little bit difficult to imagine, although it would be a counterfactual, exactly how much the monarch could directly affect a major decision that the British government is bent on taking. That said, of course, she could have said something about the atrocities in Kenya, the more than a million Kikuyu rounded up into concentration camps, treated brutally with torture, starvation, rape, forced labor, and lots of killing. She probably would not have had very much to say about the end of empire in India. She apparently did have a few things to say about apartheid, and here this is what everybody reports, that she did not like the fact that Margaret Thatcher was quite so pro-apartheid as she and Reagan both were. Which manifested in basically being very much against sanctions, but you know she didn't speak up, as far as we know, in any serious way at the period of sort of high atrocity of the unwinding of the British Empire. Malaysia, of course, being another case.
Right, the South Africa case is one that you are seeing being brought up a lot as somehow a symbol of her progressiveness or a symbol of the fact that she had a conscience, but all told, it seems as though for 70 years, she did what she was told to do. She did her job, which was to smile serenely at the camera, wear the jewels, and perform some ritualistic symbol of British ascendancy, in spite of the fact that it has now basically lost all of its colonies. I mean, would you agree that that was what she did, and she played a part? And yet, of course, because we've had maybe a lot of TV shows in recent years about the royals, that somehow people are mourning the loss of this person and feeling, quote unquote, rudderless.
For that very reason, I have great difficulty watching those shows. First of all, there's some pretense that in the modern royalty that the things they do matter so greatly. They don't. And as far as I can tell, she was a certainly morally unremarkable person with a job that involved doing extremely unremarkable things. And, obviously her figurehead role means a lot to a lot of people in Britain. I find it incomprehensible, but I'm not going to tell them they can't feel that way. And, you know, when she made her statement about COVID, it provided for them a welcome contrast to the idiocy and blustering of a Boris Johnson or a Donald Trump. But that's basically the most you can say for a highly privileged person, given an opportunity to influence world events in some degree, which she did, had to do nothing to earn, who never did anything particularly remarkable, innovative, or insightful in that regard, who may have spoken against apartheid and, who knows, possibly because she found Margaret Thatcher annoying in the 1980s when it was becoming more common. I never heard that she said anything about the Sharpeville massacre or about Rhodesia before that. I guess one thing I would focus on a little bit more is that, it's a given that that the monarchy is not supposed to affect major policy. It's not supposed to talk politics. The few times she did, like when she said something disparaging about Arthur Scargill during the miners' strike in the 80s, it was a big scandal because you're not supposed to. But one thing, I think that she could, and of course should, have done and said something about is the massive royal estate. Instead, when investigators started talking about how much money was tied up in the property of the royals, not just the queen, but the whole bunch of them, she was unhappy about that. She was happiest with figures lowballing them. She never said anything about any moral obligation to return any of that to the victims of colonialism.
Right.
That's something she could have said and maybe even had some influence in, because at least nominally, a lot of that belonged to her.
There are a lot of social media posts of all of the jewels that she's pictured wearing. And, of course, it's always important to fact check everything once he's on social media. But ostensibly, many of those jewels were the spoils of empire that could have been returned, at least as some sort of gesture that could have even given the monarchy a little bit more legitimacy in a modern society. But she didn't. She didn't, none of those things were returned. And then in her own country, as you point out, the royal family uses unearned privilege and benefits from unearned privilege. And there is, remarkably, even though you see a lot of the obituaries lauding her legacy, the monarchy, as I understand it, is not as popular even within Britain today as we might imagine it is, right? Younger people don't see the point often of these royals other than showing us all of the privilege that they have by virtue of birth. So it seems as though that the monarchy is losing legitimacy even within England. What do you think? And Britain in general.
And there, Elizabeth played a role that I don't know that I would fault her for it directly, but I think you can make the case that it was a pernicious role. So when she came to the throne, I mean, why did she come to the throne? Because her uncle abdicated. Right, he married a divorced American,
a commoner.
He had to abdicate in order to do that. It so happens that he and his wife were both huge Nazi sympathizers, and even Elizabeth, at the age of 7, there's a picture of her doing a Nazi salute. Although I don't think we can blame her for what she did when she was 7, but stuff like that happened. Her father was not good at public appearances, smoked too much, died young, and Elizabeth is the one who rescued the popularity of the monarchy. the monarchy was in a really good position to fade away with this kind of clowning around, followed by, you know, the after World War II, the labor victory with a sort of repudiation of the elitist past that certainly it was to many people who voted for labor for the first time, and she rescued it, and she somehow managed to keep it afloat as a popular thing. Although of course I think Diana had a lot to do with that before her own break with it, but it survived the scandals of the 90s, the death of Diana, and of course the random Harry does a Nazi salute, you know, kind of stuff that the younger ones have done. And right now with a you know, a successor who is a little bit odd and who, among other things, is apparently very bent on taking his fortune and investing it in such a way as to make himself as rich as possible, but it's not clear what else he's bent on. It's a good time for the popularity of this institution to fade away. I mean, it represents, of course, a modest drain on the exchequer, enough to be noticeable, not enough to cripple the country, of course. But it mostly represents a real concession to the idea that some people are just born better and more important than you, and you should look to them.
Right. I mean, it just seems so bizarre to hear defenders of the monarchy come up with whatever logic they need to justify it. And of course, among the defenders of the monarchy are people like Tucker Carlson of Fox News, who's slamming critics of Queen Elizabeth. You know, the woke liberals don't like the fact that she was the last best thing about Britain. He made lots of bizarre comments. And of course, he had some good fodder because there were some folks who said some very cruel things about a person who died. But you might make a case for why they might be justified in feeling that the symbol of British imperialism was, one symbol was dying, at least. There's this sense here in the United States as well, while most Americans are either ambivalent about the monarchy or they kind of like the idea of it through pop culture, then there's this dark strain around the Trumpists who really feel that the United States ought to return or to become an authoritarian state. And they like the idea of a potential monarchy rising up, and the Tucker Carlsons are among them. I mean, I know it sounds so far-fetched, but these are among the defenders of the Queen, and that should tell us something, right?
Well, I mean, it's funny because I don't think they like the idea of a constitutional monarchy.
Right.
I think at this point, it's a lot of this is their version of shock the bourgeoisie. Anything that liberals or rational people or people who know stuff want to say, they want to oppose it. Yes, they're very, very pro-authoritarian, and that's why they love Viktor Orban. And would love Xi Jinping if he wasn't on the other side, and love Vladimir Putin. And maybe they're throwing the Queen into that box, though she was certainly not in a position to be an authoritarian ruler. But I think it's mostly a matter of just, contrarianism, which is part of what the whole right wing has built its brand on. I would say one thing though, which is that, so the Queen had this funny position. The monarch is the head of state. The prime minister is not. The prime minister is the most powerful person in the country, at least as long as they go through the various forms, but is not the head of state, does not have the massive pageantry about it. I mean, we, in this country, we elect a person, or the electors do, who starts out as an ordinary person, but then has, you know, when so far he gets elected, every time he walks into the room, they play a damn song.
Yeah.
And this person also has power. There's some case to be made for separating this kind of thing and treating a president or whoever you elect as an ordinary person who happens to be in a position of power, and not instituting this elaborate machinery of deference around them the way we do with the president, the way we didn't used to do with the president. But, you know, that's a different story, and I certainly wouldn't suggest a monarchy as the appropriate alternative model.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up the prime minister as well, because Britain has a new prime minister. Literally days before she died, Queen Elizabeth, you know, gave whatever special dispensation she's supposed to give to anoint the next prime minister of the country. And Liz Truss, who was once somebody who was anti-monarchist, she didn't believe that the monarchy had legitimacy, and then of course turned it around. She's moving forward with a conservative agenda, right? I don't know if you have any thoughts on her. One think tank just put out an analysis saying that her tax plan and her energy plan is going to give the richest families in the UK twice as much benefit as the rest. So she's sort of carrying forward the politics of austerity. And she's, you know, this is where the real power within Britain at least lies, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, to the degree that we had any information about what Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss stood for.
These were the two contenders in the Conservative Party. Yeah.
Without liking either of them, it did seem right from the beginning that Liz Truss was the worst choice of the Conservatives. And yes, I mean, there's a thing that I sometimes call neoliberal austerity. So austerity, of course, generally means more taxes and less spending. But sometimes things that they call austerity mean more taxes for some people, less taxes for the rich, less spending for some people, more spending for the rich. Not exactly strictly austerity, but it does make the people with the tight belts tighten their belts more.
Right. Well, I want to thank you so much, Rahul, for joining us, helping shed some light, first and foremost, on the legacy, such as it was, of Queen Elizabeth II. Thank you, as always, for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
My guest is Rahul Mahajan, the author of two books on the Iraq War, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, and The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He teaches at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls, and he is the U.S. Foreign Policy and Empire Correspondent for this program. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Kitsap. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.